host, Troy. You can find me at Rockstar Troy on Twitter. Today's episode, the very first episode of the Geek Gamer Guild podcast, we will be talking about the 1999 PlayStation 1 classic Final Fantasy VIII, the eighth installment of the Final Fantasy series. And it is notable for a few departures from the typical series, as well as leading the series down a completely new path of a more futuristic style. Before we get into all of that, though, we've got a couple of shout-outs to go for. Starting off with, this podcast is part of a soon-to-be-named podcasting network and multimedia network. And we have a couple of different options for you if you're looking for podcasts. We have the Shadowvane podcast if you're into serial horror. That can be found at shadowvane.net, as well as found on iTunes and I believe Stitcher. I believe all of our podcasts are on iTunes and Stitcher. If you are a wrestling fan, we've got two different options for you. We've got the Rundown Wrestling podcast, which I also will co-host from time to time. We have the Raw Attitude podcast, which is hosted by Henry Hugepex, the Suplex Throwing Human Duplex, and who just recently gave a little shout out to our show, Sight Unseen, which is really nice of him. Give him a listen. He is chronicling all of the WWE Raw episodes from the Attitude Era. If you are into anime, which I suspect a couple of you will be, if you are also gaming, geek and gaming fans, we also have Tuning Japanese, from the same guy who brought you Shadowvane, as well as two other guys. It is a show with three guys in their 30s who talk about anime. So, getting right into it, I have a very long history with Final Fantasy VIII. This was right it's sort of the beginning of my gaming life. And Final Fantasy VIII really was one of those games that just took me by surprise and by storm. Just looking back, it is a PlayStation 1 game, and looking at it now, of course, you would say, well, it doesn't quite hold up graphics-wise, but if you think about it, from 1999 on the PlayStation 1, the graphics were pretty stellar on this. It had a great deal of FMVs, full motion videos, that were really pushing the limits to what the PlayStation could actually do. Now I said that there was a couple of different departures for the series. One being, this is the first game that did not have MP. Instead of having the magic points, you instead had to collect magic, usually through drawing of creatures, or also from draw points that you would find randomly throughout the world map and throughout the game, which was pretty sizable departure, honestly, but it allowed for every single character to have essentially any magic that was available in the game, so no real limitations there. It also had a little bit more of a departure in terms of the fact that the summon monsters, now called Guardian Forces, were also very different as well, because of the fact that you were able to junction them onto people, so it wasn't just a matter of having a list of summon monsters that you could go through. You actually had characters who were specifically have just access to certain ones of these Guardian Forces. And the entire name Guardian Force comes from the fact that in the game, and we're going to get into the incredibly long and complicated gameplay or world that you really have with this. But to start off with, let's go ahead and say it. This game does not have any voice acting to it, so a lot of times you might hear me mispronounce names. It's just because that's headcanon for me. A lot of this is you're just reading. So it wasn't until later that we started to get some more. The series talked about a little bit more that we actually got like the actual pronunciations for the names. So if you get a little butthurt over the fact that I mispronounce things, fuck you. So, this world is, doesn't really have a name for the world, really. They don't really kind of, like other places have Ivalats, things like that. We have a world that appears to be rather military in nature. We have these areas called gardens, which are essentially places that are training mercenaries. And it seems to be the main thing that the world is concerned with is you've got your normal average citizens, you've got your kind of army men, and then you've got these guys called Seeds, which go about the world, do little missions for different organizations. The game kind of has you take on that role for a little bit, but not for very long. So you don't really get to see how often these missions come up. You don't really get to see kind of, you know, what would keep going, because you just get thrown right into some of the shit that goes down on this. So the game starts off with an incredible beginning to it, where you get the fight between the main protagonist and the main antagonist. So I'll just go through some of the characters. We have our main character, Squall Leonhart, which I always called him Lionheart in my head, but I realize now that's definitely not his name. It's another one of those characters that you can change his name. So, you know, Squall is his default name, but again, it's one of those ones where, I mean, I almost never played just as Squall, so actually calling him that took a little bit of time. He is your typical kind of reluctant hero of the series, very much a lone wolf. He has kind of a divisive weapon in the game. Some people love it, some people hate it. It's a gun blade, and if you put a little bit of logic to it, it makes no fucking sense. Is it a sword? Is it a gun? Where are the bullets coming out of? How are they getting hit? It doesn't make a lot of sense, but it sure looks fucking cool. Squall starts off by getting into a training battle with Seifer Elmsay. I always call him Elmsay. Seifer, who's actually my favorite character of the series. Or of Final Fantasy VIII, potentially of the entire Final Fantasy series as well. He is your sort of main antagonist, but he also, a lot of what he does, you can kind of chalk up to the way he was raised, the way a lot of these people were raised, but also the fact that he is kind of a puppet through a lot of this, so he's not exactly your typical bad guy. He's not the end boss, that's for sure. And a lot of the times you wind up feeling kind of sorry for him and a lot of the things that have happened in his life. So a very big departure from just your typical, hey, here's this guy, he's super bad, you know, he's just evil to the bone, he's killing everybody. Seifer doesn't really do that. So we start off with a battle between Seifer and Squall, and Seifer does a little cheating, throws a little magic Squall's way, and winds up gashing him across the forehead, leaving a scar, to which Squall then returns a favor. So you've got these guys with matching scars. Wouldn't even call them matching, they're different directions, but that kind of links them for the rest of this game. Even though Seifer kind of bows out in the middle of the game for a while, comes back, bows out again, and then you don't really see him until the end of the game. So the beginning that we get is the two of them are seed candidates. They are going on a mission to try to get to become full seeds, and they are joined by the instructor, which is Questus Trepp. And Questus is, I think, maybe a year or two older than her students, so it really kind of goes to show you she's never really presented as an incredibly competent teacher. Even though she does have kind of a fan club, in fact, she very quickly gets demoted shortly after their mission. So Questus is kind of a child wonder. She really rose to the ranks, which is why at 19 she's already an instructor. This game has a little bit of a uniqueness to it as well, with the fact that there's not really a love triangle so much as a love square, because you've got Squall and Renoir, who are, of course, our main two people. Then you've also got the fact that Renoir and Seifer were together for a while, but also that Questus has a thing for Squall. It's not really covered too much in the game, but there are aspects of it for sure. Some of the other characters is we get introduced as well to Zeldinkt, who is from the nearby town of Balab, which is like five houses and place to rent a car. He is a martial arts guy. His weapons are his hands. He is also kind of a loudmouth. He's got a giant face tattoo, which I thought always kind of looked really ridiculous. But he is also a candidate. And they go on their first mission to a town called Dalit, which apparently used to be a much more bustling town, but came under the rule of the Galbadia army. And I don't know how much I want to get into on the background of this, because it is a very, very large, diverse world on this one. Really good history to it as well, which you get little bits throughout the game. I could probably go on for about an hour just on the history on this, just because of the fact that they do pack this world. They do a lot of world building, which is great. So what they're doing is they're right now, Dalit is in a war with Galbadia to try to gain independence. There seems to be a lot of different smaller towns that are trying to gain independence from Galbadia. Galbadia utilized the fact that they won the Sorceress's War, which was an event that took place years ago, where a sorceress took over a town called Esther, which is a technologically advanced city, and through some different things were able to defeat her, launch her ass off into space, which, yes, this, I think, is the first Final Fantasy game that space has actually been a playable area on it. You do actually go out into outer space, which is kind of crazy. There's also aliens in this, which is a little bit nuts for the series as well. A lot of departures, you know, and I do know that some people had a problem with the fact that, you know, there are some gun-wielding people in this. One of the main characters has a gun, you know, as well, and it's not so much your sword and shield kind of Final Fantasy game, but, you know, Final Fantasy VII had a guy with a gun for an arm, so I'm not too worried about that. I know that there is more of a futuristic element to Final Fantasy VII as opposed to Final Fantasy VIII, as opposed to Final Fantasy VII, which is more of kind of a slum, but still a little bit more technologically advanced. Then they just kind of, 9 is a very much return to roots kind of thing. 10 takes you right back into it, where it's we did have a lot of technology, and now we're rebelling against it, and now we've gotten to the point where 13, you're fighting robots all the time. So the series kind of keeps playing with it, and has finally, I think, decided that the time of doing kind of the old school Renaissance fair kind of fighting is probably not what they're going to be doing very much anymore. So during the first mission, we get another one of our main characters, Selphie Tilmet, and I like Selphie a lot, but she tends to fit a little bit more into the old school kind of useless ditzy girl kind of thing that we've seen in the past from different games. Not as much in Final Fantasy, but she definitely is slightly more damsel in distress. She does fight, but a lot of the things that she also does is, you know, I mean, she's kind of a carefree spirit, but also seems to be a little bit more weaker than a lot of the other characters in this, where you've got kind of a polar opposite with Quistis, where she is, Quistis is a lot more kind of badass. Now, Selphie is kind of the in-between Quistis and Renova, whereas Renova is literally, you have to save her quite a bit in this game. Thankfully we've finally departed from that in Final Fantasy XIII, where your main character is a female, and is not really in need of saving all that much. So Selphie is actually a transfer from Trabia Garden, and Trabia is another kind of power, but not really that big of a player, more to the north. They seem to be a little bit more kind of Switzerland in this deal, where they're just kind of there, but they do train their own seeds as well. So Selphie has transferred over to Balib. I don't know that we ever really get a reason why. If we did, and I just have never remembered it, you know, drop it on the Facebook on why exactly was Selphie transferred over to Balib Garden. But afterwards, of course, the mission doesn't go quite as planned. We get our first of many appearances of Biggs and Ward, two characters that anyone who's played Final Fantasy before are fully aware. Biggs and Ward are recurring character names, as well as Cid in the series. Biggs and Ward from actually Star Wars episode four, A New Hope, the original Star Wars. There are two characters, Biggs and Wedge, and of course Porkins. Porkins doesn't show up ever in Final Fantasy games, but those names seem to have stuck and are continually used throughout Final Fantasy. I think they're in most of them, with a couple of exceptions. So eventually, yeah, and I don't want to get into too much of this because of the fact that I'm not going to get into too much of spoilers. There's going to be a little bit of it, but I still want you guys to go out and play this game in case you haven't played it. But eventually we are introduced as well to the last of our party, Irvine Kidias, who is a sniper, which again, like I said, a guy with a gun as his main weapon. You do wind up getting some rather interesting moments where a guy shotgun blasting somebody in the face doesn't do as much damage as a guy punching someone in the face, or a dog flying out of nowhere and slamming into somebody might do some more damage than a guy with a fucking shotgun blasting somebody, but you know, fuck realism. So Irvine is kind of an asshole through the beginning of the game. Very much a loner. He very sexist towards the females on there, doesn't really seem to give them much respect. Eventually, obviously, he turns it around as well, but kind of represents the at least the team is pretty diverse here in what you've got. And then we've also got a very strange aspect of this where we have a dream world, which I don't know how much I want to go into it, but you have three other playable characters who are in the past, and that is Laguna Lore and Kiro Seagill and Ward Zabak. And these three guys are in the Galbadia army during the Sorceress's War. We get there through a very strange means where whoever was in your party at the time often is the people that go over. Otherwise, there is certain storyline-wise on how they decide which of your characters go through there. But everything that's junctioned to those characters follows you over into this dream world here. So you get it where Laguna will be able to summon Ifrit or Shiva or use some of the magic that you've got. And it makes it where if you think too much on it, you know, the whole time travel aspect of it doesn't make a whole lot of sense, creates a lot of issues there, but it is what it is. Still a very interesting story. Those three guys have a very interesting story as well. They're kind of the B-plot of the whole game, but they actually wind up being pretty important to the game themselves. And then your main bad guy being Sorceress Edia. The whole Sorceress thing, there seems to be really one or two main sorceresses, and then their whole kind of line is they rise to power. When they die, they have to transfer their power to another person. So you get a lot of it where, you know, your current sorceress probably got her power from the previous sorceress, and for whatever reason, that power seems to keep corrupting them, and they pretty often are bad guys throughout the entire kind of history of it. So not sure why that was never really kept in check, but yeah, you know, what are you going to do? So storyline wise though, you know, this game is pretty long, pretty diverse. You're going to put a good 40 to 80 hours into it. I mean, when I was playing the game, you know, it was pretty much my full-time job playing this game. I put into so many hours on the thing. And the series has continued to live on in different iterations as well, where, you know, they will release it on PlayStation Network because people just love playing the Final Fantasy games. A lot of the characters have shown up in different things like Dissidia or any of the other kind of Final Fantasy spin-offs. And the side game in this, actually Triple Triad, which I think is one of the best game within a games that Final Fantasy has ever had. It's a card game. You can actually play it now on an app as well. And they actually, in Japan, came out with physical Triple Triad. It's a pretty straightforward game. Again, it's a kind of a time waster that you can do. But it really is a lot of fun. You wind up kind of collecting, you become a card collector in the game. And you'll be able to collect all the characters, all the GFs, as well as a couple other main things, and all the monsters that are in the game as well. Different abilities, Triple Triad kind of keeps going through, and they have a couple different characters that you can fight that are specifically just Triple Triad players. And it winds up being a lot of fun. I think it's a lot more fun than the other game that they have within it, which is Chocobo World. And I was never a big fan of that. They did it on the Pocket Station, which was also then compatible with Final Fantasy VII, which you could control Boko, who was in Final Fantasy VII. I never really got into the Pocket Station that much, and I did play it a little bit, but it was never really my thing. So. And then, in terms of the history of the game, I mean, like I said, if you go out and play it, I think that it's a lot of fun, especially if you like Final Fantasy games, especially if you like JRPGs. It is a departure from the series, but I think there is still a lot of things very, very heavily rooted in the mythology of Final Fantasy, as well as the bringing forth a lot of the normal, really good elements of turn-based battles. And Final Fantasy has always been known for fantastic storylines. So, can't say enough about that. And honestly, this game is one of my favorites. I thought it would be a great first episode, and especially for the fact that, not sure exactly what, how well I'm going to be able to do this podcast series. It's going to be much better than my last attempt at a podcast, but eventually we'll get a little bit more. I'll probably revisit Final Fantasy VIII at some point in time in the future, potentially with maybe with a guest host here or there as well. But I think that this is a really good place to start the podcast. And on top of that, I think it's a really good kind of launching off point for the YouTube channel that I've also created for Geek and Gamer Guild Podcast, where I will actually start to do some streaming of my video game playing. Most likely starting with Final Fantasy VIII, potentially we'll be able to get Lemon Nerd Boy, who makes Tuning Japanese, as well as Shadowvane, to maybe put on some of his stuff as well. He's on Twitch TV, does a lot of his playthroughs. He's been currently playing Final Fantasy VIII as well on his channel. So stay tuned for more for sure. But in the meantime, head over to the Facebook page, hit like on there, start getting the conversation going. I will look into the next game that we're going to talk about, and by we, I mean me, but maybe eventually I'll be able to get a guest host on this. But that's been episode one. Go out, play Final Fantasy VIII. It's a great game, and we'll see you soon.